Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hey everyone, did you know that the Fides Club is supported by its listeners? It's true. You can go to patreon.com/thefidesclub and join the hordes of wonderful listeners that support the show financially. The link is in the show notes so you can access it from anywhere easily and quickly. Thank you everyone for your support. This is the Fides Club for November 2017. We talk about Africa, China, Germany, and we talk about the role of government. Enjoy. Hello, everyone, and welcome back to the Fides Club. This is a show where we get people from different parts of the world, different cultures, different backgrounds, and we get together and discuss what's been happening in the news in the past month or so. My name is Patrick Beja, and today I have a wonderful panel of different people from different parts of the world, as the show demands. First, let me welcome back, after a long absence, Eric Olander, who is now in Shanghai. How's it going, sir?
Wonderful. It's great to be back on the show and to talk with everybody, and I'm really looking forward to our discussion.
So you have a very specific area of expertise. You know China very well, of course, and you also know Africa, which is going to make this episode really interesting because things have been happening there in the country of Africa,
particularly,
right?
Relevant this week of all weeks with what's been going on in Zimbabwe. But I have been hosting the China and Africa podcast now for 8 years, and the China Africa Project blog, Twitter feed, and almost 500,000 folks on LinkedIn who are following our discussions about China Africa. So So great timing this week for a show like this.
I'm very, very curious to hear what you'll have to say about China's influence in what's been happening in Zimbabwe. And talking about Zimbabwe, we also have Tafatswa joining us from Zimbabwe. And I'm really glad we can get you on because, as we were hinting at, there are some things happening there. How's it going?
I think everything's going well. Everyone's excited. I mean, it's just a different environment from a week ago, even more different than a week before that. So, I mean, it's like a period of immense change. And so we're watching to see what happens and you know, what the new direction looks like.
Yeah. So we're going to talk about this. I will mention we had a special about Zimbabwe a couple of months ago, and we had Bongai on the show, and we mentioned at the beginning of the show that we weren't going to talk about the political climate because it was hazardous to discuss these things at the time. and now
I'm sure Bongai would have spoken, as would I. It wasn't as bad as people said. I mean, unless you were saying something pretty bad, people just left.
Right. So we'll get into that. But I'm happy that we can talk about all of this a little bit more freely. You'll notice that there is no Turkey on the show today. I would have loved to be able to discuss what's been happening in Saudi Arabia. Unfortunately, there are also maybe some reasons that some people might not be able to discuss this. Turkey is having a wonderful time in Japan at the moment, so he's not on the show. But yeah, I guess you understand that the situation is complicated anyway, and take those hints and get why we might not have been talking about things in the past few months. But we are going to be able to talk about Germany, where things were going okay, and now things are not going great. But thankfully, Matthias is here to let us know about all of this. How's it going, sir?
Oh, thank you for having me on again, but I'm not sure I'm a really good turkey substitute.
Well, no one is a good turkey substitute, but you will be able to tell us why Angela Merkel is in trouble, apparently.
Yes.
It was going okay-ish, and now not so much. But
ish is the right term, I guess. Yeah.
But so we'll get to that towards the end of the show. But first, of course, I want to talk about France and what's been happening there, which is basically what's been happening in Zimbabwe and Germany. I mean, there are some things, some local things. The mayors aren't really happy with what's being asked of them. Some more economies, more savings being demanded of the local institutions. And the mayors are not very happy. They had a congress a few days ago, and the president, Macron, went to talk to them and tried to salvage the situation, which he apparently managed a little bit, but not entirely. And there are some issues with the education community, and some students are being also somewhat unhappy. The thing is, to summarize, and I'm going to get to something else in a second, but to summarize what's been happening in the political climate in France is that some people are unhappy, but everything that Macron is doing had been in his platform, in his campaign platform. So it's kind of difficult to pretend like people didn't vote for it, or did, even though he didn't have a huge majority and there was all of these issues with all of the parties getting a large percentage of the votes, so he doesn't have a huge legitimacy, but he was still saying what he was going to do. And now that he's doing it, a version of it, the people who are complaining are not getting a lot of traction. So the protests, the anger have not been followed up by a large population movement. That's not to say it's not going to happen in the future, especially as he's implementing his rigorous policies and not as much of his social protection policies that he was trying to sell us on when he was campaigning. But the bet is still, this will help the economy, and when the economy goes better, everything will go better, and we can, you know, do everything we were hoping to do.
Which, so no burning cars yet?
No, but well, you know, no more than usual, I would say. No more than usual. So that's a very quick summary of what's been happening in France. I do, however, have a short monologue, as I've been doing in the past few times, because continuing on this idea that we are freaking out too much. You know, I was playing with the idea of a stress gradient, an anger, an outrage gradient, to try and instill into people the idea that not everything deserves a 10 out of 10 anger, and sometimes you can be annoyed by something or dislike something, but not go out on social media or in the streets or to your friends and be completely outraged out of your mind. And it seems that everyone is on that mode. When anything is a little bit problematic, the outrage goes to 11 immediately. And continuing on that thought, I've been noticing that, especially in it, the sort of catalyst for this realization was the video game world, and especially the video game world on YouTube, and the amount of anger that some of the YouTubers instill in their followings about everything. And it led me to think that I think it's pretty accepted that sex sells. If you make something sexy, people are going to be drawn to it, and they're going to be, it's an easy way to get more traction. And the realization was, it's trivial when you put it like this, because it's true in everything, but the realization is anger sells. And this is really a way of presenting things that is just a way to get traction, to get audiences, to get people riled up. And it's something that is very true in the video game world, I think. You can't just be a little bit annoyed by something. You have to be up in arms and getting the pitchforks out. And of course, it's also true in the political world and political commentary world. And I'm not only talking about the right here, because I think people, especially in this audience, will say, but of course, you're talking about Fox News and they try to anger you and the Twitter accounts and all of this. I think it's very true of the left as well, and just the media in general, be it traditional or social, and even people like, it's one example, but even people like Oliver, what's his
John Oliver.
John Oliver, thank you. Even John Oliver, whose work I really enjoy, and I think he's pointing out things very cleverly very often. I think it's important to realize, consciously or not, he is trying to make people angry. And of course, you're going to have InfoWars, which is the most obvious and outrageous example of this. It's completely, you know, over the top and quite frankly, very silly. But this is an extreme of a phenomenon that I think we're seeing everywhere. And that fact that anger sells is very important to realize. And when you are at least aware of that, this is what's happening, I think you're maybe a little bit less likely to fall prey to that technique, because it's just a commercial. That's what it is. It's a commercial technique to get people engaged, angry, and an easy audience that's going to mob up and carry your message. So, yeah, anger sells is my new hashtag, and I think it's an important one, just like sex sells. So I don't know if you guys have any thing to add to this, but anger sells.
Yeah, no, I tend to agree with that. I mean, I've noticed that, and obviously, say, 2-3 months ago, I was wondering why, in our country, that doesn't work. I mean, people just don't get angry. I mean, no matter what happened, they maybe and sporadically get angry, but never. So I was, because I mean, it's something that if the economy is gone, everything's gone, and people have lost their pensions, and they still don't get angry. So I've seen it in other countries where, you know. But what the danger with anger is that you divide things, and you can never achieve anything with the division. I think that's the one thing that you have to be careful with when you do get the power, and you've divided people. You can't reach across the aisle, and because remember that everyone's still angry at each other,
right?
So I think
that's certainly where we as Americans are right now. More and more we're segregating ourselves to one side or the other. More and more we're living only with people who are like us. More and more our algorithms are segregating our feeds, so that the point is that we're only seeing information that Facebook and the various algorithms think that we want to see. There's very little diversity of opinion. And what I find interesting as an American now, there's this new routine that we often have to go through when we first meet somebody. So I was taking a flight the other day, and I sat next to an American guy on my way to Bangkok. And, you know, the first thing we're doing is kind of just sensing, which side of the fence are you on? And you're probing each other a little bit just to kind of say, are you a Trump guy? Are you not a Trump guy? Are you from California? Are you from Nebraska? And putting all these kind of these little code words together to figure out, who am I talking to? And is this going to be a hostile conversation, a short conversation, or are we going to actually agree? It turns out that he was of a political persuasion that's different than mine. And we tended to have a rather civil conversation, but it could have easily veered off into awkward land. But there's this tension now that exists, and it's right beneath the surface. It's very, very close. And it's very sad as an American that that's where we are.
And I think anger plays a big role in it, because I think sometimes anger is definitely needed, as you were saying, Tafatsua, but anger is needed, but if you're always angry, then anger loses its value. And on top of that, you kind of lose perspective on things, and you can't judge situations correctly, because you're judging them from a very emotional standpoint as opposed to a rational standpoint. So you don't get a good view on things. But so anyway, I don't want to do the entire show on anger, but really that, like, beyond the fact that we're angry, for me, what was striking in that it was in practice in the loot boxes debate that has been happening in the video game industry, whether or not you agree that those are an issue, there were a few YouTubers that were very, you know, I call them anger mongers. You know, it's really they're peddling anger as a currency to get views and likes and shares, and it's really anger mongering. You're manufacturing anger for a topic that would require concern or inquiry, and you're in jumping straight to anger, and that is a currency that those people are using for personal gain. And so, yeah, that anger sells conclusion is kind of terrifying to me. And of course, it is applicable in many, many areas. So anyway, let's switch to actually Zimbabwe and what's been happening there. And you were saying, Tafazwa, people don't get angry, but things have been changing very rapidly in the past couple of weeks. Maybe you can start with a summary of what's been happening, because I'm not sure that people, everyone listening, will know exactly what the situation was and how it's evolved. Certainly, it's been one of the main topics of discussions in the media in France. So I'm curious to hear your take on it.
Okay, so I think maybe I'll start off at the beginning in terms of when Zimbabwe became independent in 1980. It's effectively been the same cast of characters. So the guy who's taken over, President Mnangagwa, he was in the first cabinet in 1980. And the general was a general in 1980. So it's actually been these guys. A lot of these guys were pretty young back then. So I'm assuming if the president now is 75, he must have been about 35 when he was a minister in 1980. So these are guys that have been together from the get-go, since the 37 years ago. And it's not a change in any – it's still the same party. Effectively, what's happened – to summarize what's happened, I've been calling it a magic trick, because what's happened is that they've replaced Mugabe with a guy he'd just fired a week before. But in effect, nothing else. The system still remains the same. What you'll find is if you looked at a video of – 99% of the ZANU-PF politicians last week that have been saying yes, 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 fire Mnangagwa and make the first lady vice president. Now this week they're like yes, 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 fire the president and the first lady and make Mnangagwa president. So effectively, it's just they've just changed their positions.
Before we get too far forward into this, I just want to call it out very quickly. Was Zimbabwe a full-fledged dictatorship? Like, how would you describe the situation for the past 30 years?
Okay, the best way to... I think we're very... not colonized is the wrong word, but I think we're very British. You know how the... You know, I would say, look, it wasn't... you could do a lot. You could talk freely in public, et cetera, et cetera. But there are certain things... But if you're a politician or trying to become a politician, you'd find it very, very tough for you. I've never been arrested. I've said things that are critical to the government. I would be in a position where you're related to, it's impossible to not be related to somebody in government effectively you may have it a bit easier, but for the way I see it, if you are not involved in politics, it was not necessarily you would not really suffer from the political goings on. But economically, I think everyone suffered from the poor economy. But I think most people I know, you could criticize the government, but not if you didn't have a following. Most of the people would just ignore you.
Right, so it's not like there was a secret police coming and taking people in the night randomly because they said something to their, to the shopkeeper next door the day before, and that they would never be heard of again. But economically, the country suffered tremendously from that regime.
Yes, but I would want to highlight one guy though, who I think it would be remiss of me not to mention. His name was Itai Dzamara. All he did was he stood in the center of town and said Mugabe must go for a couple of years, and then he just disappeared. They just so no one admits, but obviously the allegation was that it was that secret police type element, so it's mostly activists and opposition politicians that were, but the rest of you, they'll just leave. Because if you think about it, everyone was not happy, right? So you'd have to pretty much arrest the whole country.
Right. So a couple of a couple of weeks ago. So it was a coup, right? It was, that's how we heard about it. It was basically
No. Don't. It was not. It's very, the language here is very important, Patrick, that it's not a coup, because had it been a coup and labeled a coup, then a whole bunch of international sanctions would have come down on the new government. So they were very, very cautious and careful to not call this a coup. It's actually a very subtle but important distinction to make.
Yeah, it was a national democracy initiative. Effectively, what happens is that the
initiative taken by the army, though, right?
Yes, but I'll just maybe. So I'll try and take it from the beginning, mm-hmm. just so that you understood who the characters are. So that in terms of the general, the former vice president, who's now the president, and the president, who I think are the three key characters in this. So what happens was, effectively, the Mugabe never spoke against his VP while the general was still around. So he sent him to China, which I think I said this a couple of weeks ago. I said that I think that was his the biggest mistake he did, because he sent him to China, which I think, in my view, I think that they prefer Mnangagwa to Mugabe. That's my belief, just from various information I've had. And so it was a wrong time to fire him while he was there. So he came back, the general came back, they tried to arrest him, and obviously they were prepared, and so they had army guys around him, and then the police dispersed. And so the next day he gave a warning to say, listen, this must stop right now or else. And the very next day after that, the ZANU-PF youth leader came out and he said, listen, this general is talking treason, what, and then the next thing, the tanks were coming in, et cetera, et cetera. So ostensibly what they said they were doing was separating the president from the criminals around him, which was including his wife. His wife was included in that bunch of people that they were in criminals. So this was like some senior ministers, et cetera, et cetera. And they were saying he was being influenced by these people. And if you look at it, I mean, it does look like they were influencing, because I followed quite a few of them on Twitter, and they were celebrating when the vice president got fired. So it would seem like it was like it was their mission to do so. But I think the mistake that they made was that they underestimated how unpopular the first lady was, to the extent that I think no one wanted her to take over. And I think
that's what people thought was maybe not going to happen. But my understanding, at least how it was reported here, was the first lady, as you said, was very, very unpopular, but some people were hoping that she would be, she's much younger than Mugabe, and she would be taking over after her husband would, you know, abdicate, basically. And that might have been a part of the issue.
Yeah, but no one. I know what I struggled, and I've spoken. For example, in American politics, I don't really like the Republican Party, but I'll follow a lot of guys there just to get the other side. And I've spoken to people from all different persuasions, and I'm yet to find any one person who said they liked her. You know, so it's she was extremely unpopular, you know, right. And so for her to and also what she'd done was, because remember, this wasn't the first vice president that was fired on her say so, effectively, because she would embarrass people, you know. Effectively, she'd call like senior politicians at a rally and make the guy run 100 meters to shout at him in front of everyone, and repetitively different guys. And so you can imagine that no one. In our culture, I suspect that you respect your elders, and these are people that were older than her and more senior to her, and she would humiliate them like that. So I think it tends to, you know, worry people that, okay, is this the way the country is going to be run?
Okay, before we move on to the Chinese part of this equation, what's the situation like now? Mugabe has basically said he was going to leave after a little bit of back and forth that was surprising to everyone. So he's going to leave. And what's happening now? There's elections in about a year. And what's the mood like on the ground? What are people thinking? Are they hopeful? Are they like, what do you think about this situation today?
Okay, look, I think we have to separate two things. People are happy that Mugabe is gone. I think that is the first thing that I'd have to say, that they can't separate whatever they think from that. I've never seen Zimbabweans that happy in my whole life. I was too young when Zimbabwe became independent. I was like 3 years old, so I didn't really know. So I suspect that this is what they were like. This is like just people just way overjoyed and everyone is happy and, you know, everyone's celebrating. So you'd have to maybe wait for a bit to discern what people really think about the future. So here they were just celebrating that the guy is gone. Him and his wife are gone, I think. In terms of what I think about just the general view, I think had this not happened, I don't think ZANU-PF would have won the elections, because typically after when the economy is really bad, like in 2008, they lost because of the economy. And in 2013, I do think that they won predominantly because the economy was very good, because MDC had managed the economy well. So I think that, but I think now I don't see how, because the opposition is in disarray totally. They can't agree on anything. I don't see
it. Hey, that's like Germany. Or actually, yeah. It's the majority that's in disarray. But sorry, side note. Yes, keep going.
So look, I think as it stands now, and you've got to remember something that most people don't pick up on. I think the most popular guy right now in the country is the general. I've been around. I don't think if a soldier is wearing his uniform, he's not going to buy anything.
He's not going to pay for anything.
Yeah. He's not going to pay for anything. People are just that happy with. So you can imagine what could happen. Say, for example, if he runs as the vice president. You see what I mean? So for me, my belief is that. As it stands, unless the opposition do a change to the magnitude that ZANU-PF has done, I don't see how they're going to win the election. And remember that the ZANU-PF controls all the levers in any case. So
does that mean that things are going to keep going maybe not the same way, but if there isn't an opposition, it's just, as you said, a magic trick to keep kind of the same people in place? Or do you think it's going to be a different system for the country?
I think it's going to be a different system. I've dealt with the incoming president a couple of times. I found him to be very pragmatic. He's an execution guy in terms of if things need to get done, they get done. He's very professional. So effectively, he's a lawyer. Okay. The former president was a teacher by training. So you'll find Zimbabwe's education system went very, very well. So I think people will be surprised at how much he's a stickler for accountability, following the rules, et cetera, et cetera. Mm. And I think that he's got good relationships across the board. I don't know everyone, but across the board, people, in fact, most people so if it was ZANU-PF, he's the guy they'd like to have there, compared to the other guy. So I think it's one of those that I think people are. For me, I think he'll run the economy well. He's not a utopian like the previous president. This one is a very pragmatic guy, and I think he'll do what needs to be done to fix it. And I think for himself, he'd like to also create a legacy for himself, I think.
Okay. All right. So let's turn now to Eric with the Chinese involvement in all of this. And, I mean, I'll let you talk about this.
Sure.
You can do it better than I can.
Well, this was significant, and it's hard to overstate China's importance in Zimbabwe. It dates back to the 1960s when China and Mao Zedong supported the revolutionaries. A lot of the current leadership, from President Mnangagwa and to General Chiwenga, all trained in China. So they have deep relationships that extend back decades.
I've noticed that the international press and whatever struggles with the guy's name. It's Mnangagwa. So
Mnangagwa. Like, thank you. I appreciated that. And so they date back a long time. And so what made this, the events of the past week so interesting, of course, were the visit to Beijing 1 week before. And one has to wonder what happened during that visit. And no one really knows. And there's an enormous amount of speculation that's out there. A lot of it is false, that China was somehow involved, that China somehow orchestrated, that China somehow even may have given a blessing to this. We don't actually know what the Chinese said, if this was discussed, or to what extent it was discussed. Most analysts believe that Chuenga, when he went, the army commander, when he came to Beijing, he did probably notify them. There is some reports that the military also notified the U.S. embassy as well. But what's interesting is I don't think 10 years ago Chuenga would have gone to Beijing. They said that this was an already scheduled trip, and it was just part of the normal state-to-state relations that China and Zimbabwe have. But 10, 15 years ago, had an overthrow of this nature been planned, as it seems it was, because this was a very organized operation, they might have gone to London. They might have gone to Washington. Maybe Brussels. They certainly wouldn't have gone to Beijing. So from my vantage point, this was significant. This was significant in a number of different ways, even though Zimbabwe strategically for the Chinese is absolutely meaningless. This is not a geopolitically important country for the Chinese. Sure, it's got diamonds. Sure, it's got tobacco. It has some resources and minerals, but nothing really that the Chinese can't find elsewhere. What was significant, though, from my point of view watching this, was again the idea that Chuenga went to Beijing. He still kept the schedule. He then most likely informed the Chinese of this. And the fact that the Chinese did not vocally oppose it was also very significant, because the Chinese government is not a government that endorses regime change. That's an American thing for the most part, or it used to be. And the lack of any American presence in this discussion is also absolutely fascinating, that increasingly the Trump administration, which is a continuity of the Obama administration, are just disengaged from Africa, and they're just not relevant. So a lot of things happened here, and the fact that the Chinese are going to be a key player in the economic development going forward, most likely Britain as well, will be significant.
So how involved is China in all of this? I'll ask you, Eric, in all of this, I really mean Zimbabwe, but Africa in general, and maybe you can give us a couple of examples, because we sort of hear tangentially that they're involved, but we don't know to what extent. And then I'll go back for a conclusion with Tafatswa to ask if you feel that that involvement in day-to-day, life. But first, yeah.
Okay. Eric. So China is not involved in Africa. China is the most important player in Africa today for the continent. There's $220 billion of bilateral trade. Particularly for Zimbabwe, 74% of all FDI into Zimbabwe comes from the Chinese. China is the top export market. $4 billion of aid investment coming in 2016. I mean, China is even going to be building the new parliament building in Harare. So the idea that is China involved in Africa, we're long, long past that. The question is now is China's engagement in Africa, is it constructive? Some people say yes, some people say no. You can see exactly what you want in the China relationship. You can sit here, and we've talked about this in the past, where you can sit here and say it's the worst thing that's ever happened to Africa, and in many ways you'd be right. And at the same time, you can say it is by far the best thing that's ever happened to Africa, and you would absolutely be right as well. This is a very, very complicated relationship that exists on many, many different levels. But the fact is, though, is that the Chinese are more focused. In fact, just today, the Djibouti president is in Beijing meeting with Xi Jinping. And one of the things that you'll see is that even tiny little countries like Djibouti, although they're geopolitically very important, they get face-to-face time with the Chinese president. When, dozens of African leaders went to Washington 2 years ago, they sat in a group with Obama. Right. And it shows you the difference and the attention that the Chinese are paying in Africa compared to, say, other countries as well. But for the most part, Europe's influence on the continent is declining rapidly. The United States is just missing in action. The United States still doesn't have an assistant secretary of state for African affairs. So we have nobody in the State Department who's overseeing Africa strategy. And this is really, this is China's moment in many ways in a place like Africa.
So Tafatswa, do you feel that influence every day, or is it more of a...
No, No, he's absolutely spot on. And I travel a lot through Africa, and I see it everywhere. It's not just Zimbabwe; it's everywhere. Kenya, Uganda, Ghana. Anywhere you go, you see the influence. It's not very clear.
What form does it take? I guess practically.
I'll give you examples. Okay, if there's a project. Okay, so for example, they're doing a hydroelectric. Hydroelectric extension for Kariba, which is like a power generation for hydroelectric, and so what they do is they always bring. So if they're not just going to lend you money, you have to buy from them, and then their guys have to do the installation, and they leave you. So the guys I've spoken to, they leave you with no hire. So you still need them back to actually.
To maintain the installations and
so it's not and you know what we'll start because before it's Zimbabwe is not a huge country that you know these things are not they're not easily perceptible, but you start to see a lot of Chinese people. There's the Chinatown. There's like a mall that they've just done that's Chinese and you know a Chinese speak, and that's where they mostly go to. You'll see restaurants that were never there before. I mean, there were Chinese guys before, but there wasn't that many of them. But now you can see that there's a lot of them now. So look, for me, it's something that you're uncomfortable with because I don't really know their culture well enough. I sort of read about it, and you know, but you whereas if it's like a British guy, I mean, I wrote British exams in school. My teachers were from the UK, so it's something that I'm a lot more comfortable with. And so what happens is you have to try and understand if your wariness of them is not because it's culturally foreign to you, as opposed to it being better or worse. But I think in a lot of respects, our cultures are similar. Even because I was thinking about it to say. What's likely to happen in Zimbabwe now is that it's going to be economically much better, but then politically probably more along. So if the opposition wins, it's probably an American UK type of democracy. If ZANU-PF stays in charge, it's more a Chinese type of democracy. Mm. So I think it's one of those you'd have to ask yourself honestly if you're not just scared of them because you don't understand them. But what I know for sure is that I've got a brother right now. Previously, he would have gone to a British or American university, but he's in China. Right. So people are starting to realize that, listen, you're better off learning in China, learning Chinese, because I think that's where the money is going to. And I suspect that, look, America is going to get overtaken at some point in maybe 2030 economically. Yes, it won't be as nice as America, but once it's bigger economically, I think that's where we're going to have to start looking towards.
Okay. Yeah, what really struck me was what you said in the beginning, which is they lend you the money, but they build the infrastructure and they bring the know-how and don't transfer it to the local population.
Yeah, but that's actually not entirely true, unfortunately. Okay. A lot of those are anecdotal. Yeah, well, in the sense of people misunderstanding the Chinese infrastructure deals.
Right.
So a lot of people, first of all, there is this misperception that they bring over their own labor, which is actually not true. That's just it's a deeply, deeply embedded myth and researchers from top universities, from McKinsey, have moved up and down the continent, and they've found no evidence of that. 80 to 90% of all the staff on Chinese construction projects are local hires. Engineering, senior talent, project managers are brought in for those types of projects. So they're building 5 aviation universities. They're training hundreds of rail workers in Kenya and Ethiopia to go to China. So there's not a uniformity and consistency in how they do it, but they're certainly not. It's not accurate to say that they don't train people behind. That's that hasn't been the case.
Okay, but maybe if I can just jump in there. The point I was trying to make was that we could say it is anecdotal because I'm taking specific examples where I know people that are involved or who are managing the project. But effectively, I think part of the problem is that there's likely to be a language barrier. So there'll be two sets of people. In all these, because just communication may be a problem. So I think it starts to be a little bit clicky, and I think that's where I was going with it.
Sure. Yeah, no, that's definitely true. Communication is difficult. There's no doubt. But you're seeing the Chinese transform Africa in terms of infrastructure. They have a kind of a GSD. It can't swear on the show. It's a family show, right, Patrick? So it's a get stuff done.
Okay.
get stuff done type of attitude. Whereas the United States and Europeans will have 55,000 pages of regulations to implement any type of development initiative. Mm. You'll see railroads are being built, ports are being built, telecom networks are being built up and down the continent. And that's interesting. But here's the interesting point here right now, and this is the key thing, is so many people are worried about China's growing presence and influence in Africa, when the real worry is that China loses interest in Africa. And there is a lot of evidence now that indicates that the Chinese are actually losing interest in Africa. There's now the number of Chinese who are living on the continent is declining. People are going back to China and to other markets. The amount of trade has gone down precipitously in the past 2 or 3 years. The amount of investment is going down. And that's in part because 10, 15 years ago, when China first came to Africa, they didn't have as many options on where they could invest around the world. They couldn't get into the U.S. market. Europe was much more difficult. They didn't have initiatives like the One Belt, One Road. So the bigger problem facing Africa today is actually not that the Chinese are going to become too important or too big or invest too much money. The bigger concern is they're going to leave. Mm. Maybe they're going to start diversifying their investments. They do more trade now with Latin America than they do with Africa.
So
a lot of times.
I was going to go to Tafazra to ask if, you know, that perspective all of a sudden becomes something that you can see happening in the future. China divesting their interests in Africa and going elsewhere, isn't that more worrisome all of a sudden?
You know what? It depends on which way you look at it. I get the fact that capital goes where it gets the best return and best security. They're getting Latin America is quite developed in terms of the markets, et cetera, et cetera. So it would make sense. But I suspect that, look, long term, Africa has more upside, I think.
No, but my question is more like from the ground, you as a Zimbabwean citizen and, African citizen, if you look at the influence of China, maybe some people look at it and think, you know, there's some form of colonialism or some kind of interest seeking from China. But if we flip it, as Eric was saying, and we think, well, let's imagine that tomorrow, I'm just going to go to extreme just for the sake of argument. Let's say tomorrow China says, all right, we're done here. We are not interested anymore. And everyone packs up and leaves. And, you know, the Chinese citizens go and investment, infrastructure, everything, they leave. Is that a worrisome prospect?
Yeah, it would be. I mean, obviously, if you lose investment, you're taking steps backwards. So unless you can replace it with, but I'm assuming they're scaling back. They can't take back what they've already invested. Scaling back, not investing anymore. But I would say that that's probably also an indictment on African leadership, because if you have so much upside, you should be able to demonstrate that it's safe for people investing, and they can have so much growth, because the growth potential is because of the lack of development means that, you know, you are going to grow much faster.
Of course.
So if you can't market that, I think it's not really. I wouldn't blame the Chinese for that. They've got to take their money where it serves them best. But I'll then ask myself, why is it that they're pulling their money and putting it more developed markets? Why can't you provide the same security that the developed markets do?
All right. Let's spend a little bit of time on China specifically, because there are a couple of topics you wanted to talk about, Eric. And I mean, there's Tencent breaking the $500 billion value stock market value on one hand. And I mean, what's happening there in China?
Yeah, this is all part of the past few weeks. A few things have happened. And when you ask me kind of what we should talk about on the show, and Zimbabwe is very much a part of this. Just as I said, I think it's significant that Chiwenga went to Beijing, and that was a moment. We've also had a couple other key moments over the past month here, which are, you know, very, very important and things that in Europe and the United States, they just don't pay attention. They just don't get it. So the 18th Party Congress came and went, and that is basically the most important political event in China, where Xi Jinping consolidated his power. And he's now the strongest Chinese leader really since the Mao era. And that's incredible because he's now atop the second largest economy in the world, the second largest navy in the world, one of the largest militaries. And this to have one person with that much power is really fascinating right now, particularly as the United States is such a divided country and such a dysfunctional government in many ways. So then we had the Trump visit, and really the sense of the Trump visit was that China's arrived. China kind of sat toe-to-toe with Trump for the first time in a Sino-US summit and felt as an equal. And the Americans didn't come here and lecture the Chinese. They didn't come and make human rights demands. They didn't exact any concessions out of the Chinese. Nothing. He gave nothing up. So Xi Jinping really owned the visit in so many ways. And then on top of that, we had the first Chinese company to make the $500 billion valuation club, which is significant. And so you kind of stack all of these events in just 1 month back to back to back, and you get this sense that there's something is going on. This is a very, very important moment in history right now that we're seeing unfold in front of us. And I think the Chinese were very, very surprised to see the decline of the United States as fast as it's happening right now. And they were expecting the United States power to diminish over decades. And here we're seeing it diminish right in front of our eyes. And they're grabbing the opportunity with both hands. It's remarkable to see.
Go ahead, Matthias.
Quick question, because you mentioned the Xi Jinping-Trump discussion. So is it more an issue of Xi Jinping being so strong or Trump being so weak, in your opinion?
It's a little bit of both. They know that, I mean, they're very, very tuned in with U.S. politics. They know that Trump is under investigation. They know that he's got a divided Congress. They know that he's only governing to about 36% of the country. They are very, very tuned into who his constituencies are. So a lot of the deals are done to support his constituencies. They're really flattering him in many ways. And at the same time, Xi Jinping is the opposite. He's sitting on top of a united government. He has all of the power. He controls the military, the Central Military Commission. He's, of course, in charge of the Communist Party, and he's in charge of the government. So they're in very different situations right now, and it is absolutely fascinating. Also, there's this idea now that the Chinese are trying to capture the industries of the future. So they are making a move for the auto business to set the standards for the global auto business. This, of course, is the largest auto market.
I'm going to interrupt just for a second before we move on too far from this, because I want to ask a question in no partisan terms. This is really pure curiosity, and I hope the audience understands it as such. Kind of a variant on Matthias's question. Is the U.S. considered weak now specifically because of Trump, or was it also declining under previous presidencies, including Obama's and others? Or is it something that happened with Trump's?
It's not with Trump. They don't see a sharp decline with Trump. Okay. They've seen that the United States, and I think this is the thinking inside a lot of the think tanks and the senior leadership. And again, what do I know? I'm just speculating here based on just reading a lot of things here. That's right. So I'll put that disclaimer out there that nobody really knows. But there has been this sense among the senior leadership and this sense among the intelligentsia that the United States has been in a period of decline. And this is something that started for a long time, decades. And they tap into a lot of the same frustrations. They understand the frustrations that a lot of Trump supporters have. They see that wages have not increased in the West. They see that that China has been growing very, very fast. So they look at the fact that they are regaining what they think as their rightful place atop the world economic order. Bear in mind, and this is something that's very deep in the Chinese psyche, for 2,500 years, maybe 3,000 years, China was the world's most powerful country. Only with the rise of Europe in 1500 to the present day has China stumbled. And this is very important to understand Xi Jinping and how he sees the world. He sees the world as China regaining its proper rightful place atop the world economic order and the world, and not just economics, but politics and power as well. And that's the way they're seeing things. And they look at politics in zero-sum games. If there is one that's winning, the other one's losing. And that's a very different way that we look at politics in the United States. So, yes, this is they've seen a period of steady decline of American relative power, maybe not in absolute terms. But if you look at what's happened over the past 5 years now with the South China Sea, where the United States throws this bluster, they put a ship through every once in a while, but they're not going to go to war over some rocks in the South China Sea. They know that. Of course, we know that, too. No American president will ever go to war with China over the South China Sea. So they see a paper tiger in many respects, and I think there's some legitimacy to that.
The regaining power, rightful place, it's interesting because it's my impression. I'm not very attuned with Russia, but you know, by proxy through my proximity physically, geographically, in Finland, I have a little bit more of a connection with it now, and it echoes a lot of that. Not in exactly the same ways, and we really should do a special on Russia one day. But it echoes a lot of Putin. It's a very different thing.
It's very different because Putin, at the end of the day, is a petro-dictator sitting on top of basically a commodity-based economy.
No, I agree,
China
but the sentiment...
China is highly, highly diverse. At the end of the day, there's a feeling.
Yeah.
There is a feeling, but Russia will never, ever be close to the power that China is or the United States.
It will have tremendous
regional influence, but it will never necessarily be the global power it once was.
And I think the sentiment in Russia is... you know, focused on that regional influence and the outrage that you know, other forces have eroded that regional influence, which is their rightful role. You know, it's very strange when I talk to people who are familiar with Russia or who are Russian, there's a sentiment that, what are you even asking? Like, why are we doing this in this or that country that is close to us? Of course, it's our zone of influence. Like, that's obvious. But anyway, you were going towards something that was really interesting, which is the investment in the future in China, which is also very active. Go ahead, Tavatsu.
Okay, Eric, for me, I've got a comment and a question. Okay, on Russia, I just get the impression that this is somebody who's been left behind, who's trying to assert, to put themselves to the level of the US and China when they're not. On America, I got the impression that Obama was trying to prevent China, because, I mean, it was just a matter of time, because when the economy turns over and China has a bigger economy, the way they treat it changes. So for me, I got Obama was trying to negate that or slow that down. Do you think that winding that all those attempts back didn't speed it up?
That's right, it did. So Obama he didn't handle China very well in many respects. So he was very concessionary to the Chinese. And at the same time, he was also launching programs like TPP, the Trans-Pacific Partnership, which did not include China, which was meant to be a balance, or some in the Chinese side would look at it as containment. The West looked at it, and certainly the United States looked at it as a counterbalance to China. He had the pivot to Asia, which was his rebalancing of the U.S. military priorities. Again, you're coming out to Asia in part because of China and North Korea. He did not support the Chinese, and he really pressured American partners from joining the Asian Infrastructure Bank, which is the Chinese equivalent to the World Bank in many respects. So he was very, very aggressive in pushing against the Chinese and trying to kind of slow down the Chinese ascent, if anything. And in the end, he wasn't successful at all. I mean, we can see now the Asian Infrastructure Investment Bank has most of America's partners, including the British, the Japanese, a number of different countries that are aligned with the United States are partners with it. TPP now is in ruins, and the pivot to Asia was really just nothing. So the Chinese have a certain amount of confidence now, seeing how those policies failed. And again, I think it just goes to show the dysfunction that is U.S. The current state of U.S. politics, with no real clear vision for Asia, which is the most important part of the world right now. This is where the largest economies in the world are. 60% of humanity lives here. This is where the engine of global economic growth is. And the United States doesn't have a coherent Asia policy, which is just remarkable.
All right. Before we go, we come back to Europe. I say come back because that's where I am. But before we get back to that, I really want to hear about a couple of things from China to close this off. First, the investments in the future economies. And second, I want to ask you about all of these things you've been discussing. And are they the feelings of the everyday down in the street Chinese person, if you know how they feel, or if that's more of a higher level geopolitical, discussions that they don't really care about?
You can't generalize for a country of 1.4 billion people.
Of course you can, Eric. Of course you can. That's what we do.
There's just no way to do it. And China is really it's a bunch of countries wrapped up in one. So it's really impossible to kind of say what the mood of the people are. But there is something very interesting here. China just passed the United States in supercomputer speed. China is developing Mars and Moon missions right now. China has some of the fastest growing tech startup ecosystems in the world. China is one sector after another. You're seeing China investing in new and innovative. And it's really just, again, it's exciting. I come from Silicon Valley. I come from the San Francisco Bay Area. So I'm familiar with this. And I see what I see back in the U.S. is just none of this energy that's there. Again, our president is talking about preserving coal. And I mean, coal, think about that. And this is a country here that is exporting solar panels to Africa and to other parts of the world and is developing solar cities. And, you know, I don't want to listen. This isn't a fairyland here. This is a country that has enormous problems. It's extraordinarily complex. But on one level, there's a certain level of optimism that's here. And recognizing that the future is in electric vehicles, the future is in solar, the future is in supercomputers, in big data, in all of these different things. And they're doing it on a scale that nobody comes close to. Nobody comes close to.
All right. Well, that's an interesting summary of all of this. And I certainly wasn't aware of as much of it as I should have been. But in conclusion, let's move back, as I mentioned, to Germany and give Matthias a little bit more time to speak. Because
before we move over, may I ask Eric one more thing?
Oh, sure. Of course. Please do.
Sure.
Because you said that China is losing interest in Africa. And what do they turn the interest to then? What's the new hot thing for China?
The new hot thing is One Belt, One Road. This is a $1 trillion global trading agenda that basically is, if you think of the map of the world, there's a line that goes from China down through the South China Sea, around the tip of India and South Asia, across the Indian Ocean, up through the Suez Canal, through Central Europe, Russia, back to China. That is their global trading route, the New Silk Road. And they've already spent about $250 billion. Nobody right now in the world is spending that kind of cash. They're spending more money than the United States ever even came close to spending in the Marshall Plan to rebuild Europe after World War II. So this is what's so interesting is where they're spending
the
money.
So they're building the trade routes is what you're...
They're building the trade routes. They're building massive amounts of infrastructure along this trade route. So this, what we're seeing in Kenya and Ethiopia is new rail lines, new ports in the port of Mombasa, big investment in the Suez Canal, rail lines through Central Asia, airports, data networks, huge fiber optic networks that China Telecom is stringing around the world right now to facilitate this. So that's where the money is going. And the Chinese are turning down their investment in European and American debt because they don't feel they're getting the return on that investment. They're overexposed in American debt. So this is potentially very, very dangerous for American mortgage consumers, because we're going to pay higher mortgages if the Chinese don't buy our debt. And so that just forces the Americans to put up their interest rates, Europeans as well, because they're investing in infrastructure in places like Africa, South America, and in South Asia, where they think they'll get a better return on their investment.
And I notice one thing, and I also have a question. The one thing is, of course, the new Silk Road doesn't include the U.S., but I'm guessing that's because the trading with the U.S. is already established and kind of easy to maintain. And my question would be, again, going back to the actual people in the street, do they have a perception of that One Belt, One Road initiative? Like, is it used as a, I want to say propaganda, but maybe not propaganda.
Oh, yeah.
It's not a.
Oh, no, it
right
is propaganda.
Okay.
Absolutely. Right. This is the country. In this country, propaganda is not a bad word, actually. That's one of the funny things here. So, but it is absolutely. It's called Ilui Dai, which is One Belt, One Road. And you see it everywhere. So it is very much, this is the vision of the future. It's a global trading initiative. And it's a big. And the guy on the street, you know what? He doesn't really care. Just as like the guy on the street in Germany doesn't care and the guy on the street in New York doesn't care.
Well, no, but I mean, there are, for example, in Germany, I'm sure many people on the street are concerned about the government not being able to form. So I'm wondering if in China,
they care
like,
about
that.
Well, they don't care. They have a very different relationship with politics here than they do in Germany, in part because this is not a democracy. Right. So the guy on the street has no say in what ultimately happens in Beijing. That said, if you look at public opinion of Xi Jinping, it actually runs pretty high. There's a lot of hostility towards local governments, but people look to the central government as being a source of stability. So it's kind of the opposite as in the United States, where we look at our local government and say, oh, they're great, but that Washington, those are bums. So it's really the inverse in many respects. So for the most part, public opinion towards the central government tends to be rather consistent and not too bad, in part because the central government invests huge amounts of money in propaganda and controls the media quite tightly. But that's nothing new here in China.
All right. I think, well, obviously we could talk about all of this forever, as I often say, but we are going to move on. Matthias, what the hell is happening in your country and why are you guys breaking Europe?
I have no idea why this is all happening. Well, actually, it's all our fault. So it's basically also my fault because we voted the way we did. But just a small preface before I start this whole thing. The whole issue is very complicated and it has a lot of different layers. But since explaining this would take way too long, I'm just going to break it down and simplifying a bit. But if you have any questions or don't understand anything, just jump in and ask to clarify. Also, if we have listeners from Germany or people familiar with the matter, they might notice that I'm skipping some stuff for the sake of brevity, and I'm not going to bore you with the intricacies of German politics. So please excuse if I'm skipping stuff. So, as I mentioned last time I was on the show, the election in September left us with a bit of a mess, basically, when it comes to forming a new government, because the parties that are sitting now in government are A, there are more parties than ever, and the distribution of the seats within parliament only left us with two possible coalition options that could actually get a majority. So one of these options was the so-called Jamaica coalition, which is nicknamed, as you might remember, after the colors associated with the different parties. And these four parties are the CDU, the party of Angela Merkel, the CSU, the sister party of the CDU, the Free Liberals, and the Green Party. So shortly after the election, these four parties started talks to see if they could find some common ground. And as everyone expected, this turned out to be very difficult since the parties have vast differences in their respective important policy fields. So, for example, when it comes to environment, the energy sector, or, well, even the refugee crisis, or especially the refugee crisis aspect. So for weeks, they had these talks, and instead of concrete results, all the public got were daily press briefings where they basically said nothing new. And they just said, well, we need to negotiate further. Oh, and of course, there was a lot of bickering, mostly on the part of the CSU, the smallest party in these negotiations. They are in deep trouble right now and try to overplay their weakness with screaming a lot, but everybody is used to them screaming, so there's nothing unusual there. Anyway, all of this bickering combined with the lack of concrete results led to a kind of a sense of frustration in the eye of the public and the media. And to combat this frustration, Angela Merkel set a deadline, which ended last week, for these negotiations. They didn't meet this deadline, but it seems as if they were actually making progress and were on their way to getting an agreement. But suddenly, out of the blue, the Liberals broke off the negotiations, saying they will not be part of this coalition.
Freaking Liberals, always ruining it for everyone.
Yes. Well, it was a surprise for everyone, and especially for those other negotiating parties, because they were all under the impression that it was actually going rather well and that they were just about to cross the finish line. And if anything, if a party would break this up, it would be the CSU, since they are the one who are always bickering with the other parties. So after weeks of negotiations, we basically have no new government, and the only option that it's seemingly the best one is out of the window.
And so what I'm hearing is, there are two things I'm hearing. One, what to do now is whatever happens, Merkel is going to be very weakened, and they might do a new election, which is very frightening because it might mean that the far right gets more power. And the president basically called people in his office to yell at them a little bit and tell them to get in line. So there's some kind of hope that actually the coalition might happen after all. But regardless, or maybe especially if it doesn't happen, Europe, the Union, is weakened, not in deep trouble, but it is weakened because big pillars were France and Germany, and even though Macron is pro-Europe in France, now Merkel is weakened in her pro-Europe stance, and especially with the refugee crisis, it's one of the thorns in her side when she was, well, anyway. So,
by the way, it's not just bad for Macron and Merkel, it's also bad for Theresa May, because she can't really negotiate with anyone right now, and time for the Brexit is running out. So if anything, it's a matter of bad timing for her. And as you mentioned, the much-needed reforms and initiatives to change or reform the EU are now stalled. But basically, we have three different solutions for this mess right now. So the first one would be that the parties could form a minority government, which is tolerated by the other parties in the Bundestag. So the Bundespräsident can nominate a person as the next chancellor, and if this person is not confirmed after two election attempts, the candidate can be elected by a simple majority. So if someone is just voting in absentia, they can still make him or her chancellor without actually voting for him. This would be something we see in the Scandinavian countries, for example, a lot. But this has never happened in Germany. And apart from the fact that we don't have the necessary political culture to make this happen, these types of governments are pretty unstable and could be easily overturned. So nothing German voters would prefer. And on top of all of that, Merkel isn't someone who wants to govern with uncertain majorities and constant promises. She isn't a good communicator. She doesn't like to face parliament. She doesn't defend her policies very well. If anything, she mostly deflects, hence her nickname Teflon Merkel. And
I didn't know that. That's pretty good.
It's interesting because in all of your discussion, you haven't mentioned the word migrants. And yet in what we're reading in a lot of the mainstream international press is that it was the migrant issue that gave rise to a lot
about
of the opposition parties.
Yeah.
Immigration, well, the migrants, yeah. I mean, in Germany, which is obviously a key issue, and gave rise to the far right, AfD, and whatnot. So I'm just curious, is the international media not getting the story right, according to your point of view, or are migrants really at the core of the issue for the opposition?
Well, it depends. It is correct that the refugee crisis, as it is often called, is one of the issues that led to this whole mess, because the election turned out the way it did, at a certain part because of this crisis. But for now, it's not really an issue because it has died down somewhat. There are not that many refugees coming into the country, and those who are here are getting processed. So they either get their application processed so they can stay, or they're being sent back. So it has died down a little bit. The issue is still one of the key points in the discussion between the parties for a coalition negotiation. But in the end, right now, it's not the hot topic, so to say, anymore.
So I want to ask, actually, both of you, Tafatsua and Eric, if this is playing, as always, you know, I ask if this is a matter that is being discussed in your countries. In France, definitely very much discussed, very much a concern, so I won't get more into it. I'm guessing in Zimbabwe you had other matters to worry about, and it's kind of far away anyway. And I'm curious about China as well. But Tafatsua, is it something people discuss?
Look, I predominantly watch news. I mean, that's the only TV that I watch. So whether it's CNN, BBC, Sky, Al Jazeera, whatever. So it's something that you discuss amongst friends, but obviously it wasn't the top of our heads. In terms of, you know, but maybe 2 weeks ago we would have discussed it more, but right now, obviously, we had more pressing matters.
Right. But it would be something that you discuss, even though it's so far away. It is, you know, it makes the news, I guess.
Yeah. I think the world is global now. I mean, there's nothing that you could discuss, and everyone hasn't really discussed it. Because I may not know the intricacies, but I'll know in general what's happening, I suspect that that's where the difference comes on, how much or how deep is your knowledge, as opposed to, you know, if it's not in your country, you'll know it less than if it's not in your region, but you'll still know about it.
Right.
So, for example, I'll know that, what's his name, Kushner, he's having some issues with Mueller, whatever. It's on the news, you know. So I think you discuss it if there's no pressing national issues. Then, because I think right now people have just been in Zimbabwe. Just it's a party. It's been a party this week. Let me put it that way. A huge party.
Yeah. Eric, what about China?
No, not at all. I mean, China and the U.S. are very similar in the sense that they're such huge domestic markets, and there's so much going on domestically that they really don't pay much attention to international news for the most part. Of course, a certain degree of elites have it. I read the Chinese newspapers every day. There's some passing mention back on page C5 of a newspaper, or some, you know, way down on something, but it's not a priority at all. I mean, they, for the most part, the average guy in the street doesn't really pay attention to that.
So I guess that leads me to another question. Oh, Matthias, you wanted to add
something? I just wanted to finish because...
Of course. Sorry.
Yeah, because the minority government is only one of the solutions that we could now... Because the one that is the most likely is what we call the Grand Coalition. So it's the conservative parties, the CDU, the CSU, and the Social Democrats. So basically the same thing we had the last 4 years. But the Social Democrats are a bit in a dilemma right now, because right after the elections, they publicly and very openly stated that they will not continue to be in a coalition with the conservatives at all, and will instead move over into the opposition because they lost so many votes. So their party leader, Martin Schulz, has always been an opponent of this. So everyone is trying to persuade him, and especially the Bundespräsident, Frank-Walter Steinmeier, is trying to persuade him to now start talking about it. And it seems as if he is at least willing to talk about such an option, but maybe he will be forced to resign just to clear path for this coalition options. But nevertheless,
how likely is this to happen?
What do you mean? Him resigning? Let's say there are talks about him resigning and who might be the next leader, but he is trying to put this all on the party members and saying, well, if we will consider such an option, we'll ask all the members of the party and they'll vote on it. And so maybe he can just survive by saying, well, if the members of the party say we have to do this, then I'll do it regardless.
And that's what we're hearing, which is it seems the members of the party might be switching their thinking and going to, yes, maybe we should form
They're split on this issue. But in any case, the party isn't in great shape in general. Besides, the idea of a grand coalition is something that is very unpopular for most voters. So if the SPD is really caving in, they will probably take an even harder hit in the next election. And the current election already yielded them the worst result in party history. So even if they're trying to frame the decision as taking responsibility for the country because there was no other option and so on, I doubt the voter will really see it like that. And they'll probably lose a lot of more votes. Nevertheless, it currently seems like this outcome is the most likely. And actually, the SPD is not in a bad negotiating position. Even though they have less seats than the last time, they are the only option the Conservatives have. So maybe they can make bigger demands. And the last option, just in closure, is that we get new elections. But that doesn't mean that this is really a solution, because right now the polls show that the new election would yield basically similar results as we have it right now. So nothing would be gained by voting again. Also, the prospect of seeking new elections has a bad reputation because this draws the image of the politicians that would let the citizen vote until they get the result they want and so on. So it's nothing anyone really wants. And with the already stressed mood within the country and the general disenchantment with politics, this would be, so to speak, another nail in the coffin. Besides, as you already mentioned, no one wants to give the far right an opportunity to improve their results if they don't have to.
Right. Yeah, it's that idea that you get into, like, something I hadn't considered. If you do another election, it's not just that you do another election for the sake of getting a government formed. It's also the image that, well, we didn't like the result of this election. We couldn't get together and be adults and work with each other. So we're going to do another election until we get a result we like. That's something I hadn't considered, but I would definitely feel if a government had to redo elections. It's kind of just do your job. And
yeah, basically, that's what the Bundespräsident is now saying. Frank-Walter Steinmeier made a public appeal to all parties that they should do their best to reach an agreement and that the results of the elections are the representation of what the voter wants. So therefore, they should accept it as such and avoid forcing new elections. Also, he was part of the last grand coalition as a foreign minister. So for him, it's not such a big deal. But then again, he is not really a passionate politician, but more bureaucrat. So he's more pragmatic, so to speak. He doesn't have real, passion for the whole thing. So for him, he's just saying, well, it's the only thing, so let's do it.
Right. He's wagging his finger, or he's...
Well, he can't do anything really, because he has no power to force them.
But no, but he like has
the
like
moral
status,
institution so. That says, well, now you all get together and talk about this and we'll make this work somehow. So
right,
it's
the teacher. It's the teacher saying, you know,
basically. And he summoned the party leaders of the conservative parties and the SPD for next week for some talks to maybe talk to them and convince them or lay the groundwork for a grand coalition, as it were. But nothing is decided. And again, he can't force them if he puts up someone for election in parliament as the new chancellor, and he or she doesn't get enough votes. After three attempts, he just dissolves the parliament and we get new elections.
You know what I really hate about all of this and about all of these things happening in the different countries? I think there's a lot of people looking at this, people who are already, in the camp of, well, governments are crap and politicians don't know what they're doing. I think those people look at this and think, see, I told you, the government isn't good for anything. And that really depresses me, because it is so not the case. Being in government is not easy. Doing the government's work is not easy. And this is basically trying to talk your way out of situations, or to resolve by talking and by finding compromises, situations that would lead to, you know, either social conflicts or civil wars. And of course, you're going to have some moments where it's, where it's, it looks silly and you want to tell the government, you know, the public servants to shake them and say, stop being a child and find a solution. But it's, it feels very, well, actually childish to have the reaction, ha, governments suck. It's like they do, the government has an impossible task in front of it. And I'm not saying they all do the best way. Okay,
that,
go ahead.
That is, come on, that they have an impossible task. Governments, if you are 30 to 40% of the French population, the American population, the British who voted for Brexit, you've been steamrolled and government has done nothing for you. These are, you've seen your wages for 40 years flat, not growing. You've seen schools get worse. You've seen immigration challenge, you know, the available resources in your community. How, now, I'm not defending that, but at the same time,
No. Schools aren't getting worse. I'm sorry.
Absolutely.
Education.
No. You can make a case, though that's not true at all. Public education in the United States has been in decline. We know that. We have definitive. It's more segregated today in the United States than it was during Jim Crow. So if you are one of the, you know, the unfortunate to not live in a wealthy white area, your education is nowhere near as good. And you see education funding in France is also coming under serious strain as well. And so immigrants in that sense,
well,
put strain on people.
So I'm not going to talk about the American side, but the French side I would dispute. But keep going.
But let's talk about jobs in France. Let's talk about the stability of jobs. And again, they look at governments, particularly in France and in the United States, where the rich get richer and the guy is just not winning. And again, I'm not saying that whether or not that's right or wrong, but that is the reality. The statistics support the fact that wages are not going up. They support the fact that opportunities are not growing for the next generation. And government, what are they doing? You just had a French president before Macron, who, you know, what did he do?
That would be an entirely different conversation, which would take another hour. But
government is an impossible task, and you put mediocre people there, and of course they're going to deliver mediocre results.
I want to give you a 10-minute answer so bad, but Tafatsua, you wanted to say something.
Eric, I'm sort of like smack in the middle of my view is smack in the middle of both of you. I do think governments have an impossible task in as far as pleasing everyone. You can't do that. It's impossible. However, a lot of incompetence comes into play as well, because for me, I look at government and a lot of times you look at it and you actually ask yourself, would I employ this person? No. And if as an individual I wouldn't employ them, the country definitely shouldn't be employing them. So I think there needs to be a balance between what we expect of our governments, but also the minimum must be that they deliver what they're supposed to, what a competent person would deliver. Otherwise,
absolutely,
you need to be fine.
They've got to deliver what they're supposed to, and they don't do that for them in many parts. And that's, I think, the frustration that a lot of people have.
Where is the notion coming from that a politician wants to make everyone happy? They don't want to make everyone happy. They want to make their own voters, their clientele, their target audience happy. Not everyone. I mean, that's the whole premise. I get voted by a certain group of people and I work for their interest because they voted for me. I'm not trying to make everyone happy. I am trying to maybe not make it worse for them. But why do I care about the conservative voters if I'm a social democrat, for example?
I would argue that I would hope that the government would work for everyone, yes, with a bias, but hopefully works for the country. And
yeah, of course. But yeah, it's not like you want to make them happy no matter the cost.
I have stuff to add, but Tafatsua, go ahead.
Yeah, I still think, okay, maybe make them happy is a wrong phrase. But what I'm trying to say is just you can't satisfy everyone. But remember that your job is to effectively deliver for everyone. You're not delivering just for your voters, for the people who voted for you.
No, of course you're not, but that's the reality. I mean, that's practical politics.
Well, I will say that when I'm saying they have an impossible job, I think a lot of people look at how they run a business, for example, and think, well, I could do this like that, and don't realize the complexity of running a country. You know?
It's complete garbage, you're right.
What is? You mean that they, the people, I don't understand. Do you mean the politicians are working, not working well, or?
No, I think this idea that, well, because someone can run a business, they can run a government is just garbage.
Okay.
I mean, that is because, that is just absurd. Because
they're
two different skill sets altogether.
Exactly.
And managing the constituency, stakeholders, the timing. We romanticize the scale, but we also romanticize business people as being kind of, they solve every solution and I mean, they solve every problem. And it's just, it's, they're two totally different things. I mean,
and what what I was getting at when I was saying, you know, the impossible task, I think is talking more about infrastructure and the fact that, you know, you have, well, again, this doesn't necessarily apply to the US, but healthcare, education, unemployment, benefits, retirement, you know, all of those huge things are more or less well, and certainly there are challenges as our countries and makeup of societies change, but they're being taken care of by the governments, and it's not an easy task. And going like, oh, you know, there's more unemployment and more this and more that. Yes, sometimes you hit a rough patch, and maybe there are things that need to be changed, but throwing everything out because some of it is not working is a childlike behavior. And that's what I was trying to get at when I was saying, you know, people going to the conclusion that governments suck and politicians suck and, like, you know, going to that extreme, I think is incredibly childish and counterproductive behavior.
So now you're back to
the question, though.
Yeah, go ahead.
I've never understood why politicians, because people will say governments suck, my wages have stayed the same, but everything else has gone up. But they wouldn't say my employer sucks, because I mean, that's the person paying you that wage. I mean, so I've never understood that logic to say to blame politicians for wages. Yes, their policies may affect, but surely.
Well, I would argue that the politicians set the macro conditions. You know, the macro knobs and levers for the way the country and the economy evolves. So, of course, there is some influence of the politicians. But
it is that the framework they're setting. But then again, politicians tend to glorify themselves as the problem solver for everything. They try to project this image that they can solve everything, even though they can't. It's not a single politician has ever created a job unless he's creating a position in his office or something. I mean, that's always the case, that it's only the framework, but they take they claim it for themselves anyway.
So basically the politician says, I can solve this. And then they don't solve it, so then they get blamed for it. Okay, that makes sense.
That sounds like it. Yeah, that sounds like it makes complete sense. All right, I think we're going to stop there. Thank you very much, everyone, for participating in this lively conversation. Before we leave, I do want to give everyone a chance to tell us where we can find them online, if they have some kind of online activity. And, of course, I'm going to start with, I guess, Eric. China and Africa. You know your stuff.
Yeah. Well, you can follow us. We have a discussion every week. In fact, this week's show is going to be on Zimbabwe. So I hope everybody joins us. We're interviewing folks from the South African Institute of International Affairs on all issues related to Zimbabwe. But you can find us at ChinaAfricaProject.com. Look me up on LinkedIn and follow me there. Also on Facebook at Facebook.com/ChinaAfricaProject.
Excellent. Thank you very much. What about you, Matthias?
You can find me on Twitter. The handle is @Matzekut, which will also be in the show notes. So if you want to talk more about this or tell me why I'm completely wrong or something, just hit me up there and strike up a conversation.
Tafetsua, do you have, I think you have a Twitter account. I'm not sure.
Okay, I'm on Twitter, LinkedIn, Facebook. It's tafetsua.mariere, all of them.
Excellent. I'll link the Twitter account in the
or at Tafadzwa Marere. So it's just you know my full name, so I think just use that. So if you go on any of them, I think you should be able to pick it up.
Excellent. I'll have the link to the Twitter account in the show notes, of course. Okay. And for me, it's Not Patrick on Twitter and Facebook. You can also find the show at frenchspin.com. And if you want to help out, there are a couple of ways. You can go to iTunes and leave a review. That is always helpful, of course, iTunes or any other podcast catalog. But you can also, even more importantly, go to Patreon and support the show financially. That is, of course, the most helpful and efficient way of doing it. You just go to patreon.com/thePhileas Club. The link will be in the show notes. It takes a couple of minutes. You can subscribe for one or two episodes a month or however many you want, and stop the subscription whenever you want. It's completely your choice, and it helps the show tremendously. That's how I actually finance the production. So I would very much appreciate your support. If you think the show is interesting, provides some kind of value, be it entertainment or information or anything like that. And on that topic, I'd like to encourage you to go listen to the previous episode we did, which was a special entitled Life as a Woman. We actually had, well, I had four women on the show who just told us what they, what their experiences are in daily life. And of course, their experiences with harassment and inequality. And we talked about a concept that Allison, one of our guests, discussed initially in her show, which is the idea of paper cuts, where the inequalities and the harassment isn't necessarily something that bludgeons you over the head every time, but it's paper cuts. And one paper cut is fine, but if you get multiple paper cuts every single day at work, I suspect you get tired of it, first of all, and then it does influence the way you behave every day. So we discussed this at length. It was a very challenging episode for me to do. I was trying to be as silent and respectful as I could and listen to what they had to say. I think ultimately we did a good job. We had tremendous feedback from a lot of people, so I think the episode works. Again, I would encourage you to go and listen to it. It's the previous episode in the feed. It's a special called Life as a Woman. Thank you very much to everyone for listening to this show, and we will be back very soon. We'll talk to you then. Bye.